BBC World Service. Coming up, we've a special edition of World Business Report recorded in Western Kazakhstan. Alex Ritson will be investigating reports that the Caspian Sea's caviar trade is facing extinction and looking at what will take its place. Then in 15 minutes, when you go shopping, do you ever wonder why we need so much choice of products? Belinda Rhodes asks, are we any better off having so much to choose between? First, let's get a summary of the news.
BBC News with Sue Montgomery. The two candidates in the Ukrainian presidential election have made their final appeals to voters ahead of the rerun on Sunday. The opposition candidate, Viktor Yushchenko, said healing social divisions would be his top priority, but reiterated Ukraine's strategic interest lay in integrating with Europe. His pro-Russian opponent, the Prime Minister, Viktor Yanukovych, told his supporters that voting for him would ensure Ukraine's destiny remained in the hands of its people. The American Defense Secretary, Donald Rumsfeld, has made a surprise Christmas Eve visit to American troops in Iraq. He first went to the U.S. military base outside the Iraqi city of Mosul to meet the survivors of the suicide bomb attack 4 days ago, which killed 22 people. Mr. Rumsfeld later flew on to Tikrit, the birthplace of Saddam Hussein, and then to a base near Fallujah. He ended his visit in Baghdad. There have been more reports of sporadic fighting between U.S. forces and insurgents in Fallujah. According to one report, fighting started as a small group of cars began queuing at a checkpoint on the city's outskirts, in apparent response to the call by Iraqi and American officials for residents to return to their homes in the devastated city. An unpublished United Nations report obtained by the French newspaper Libération has catalogued a series of atrocities it says have been committed by both sides in the Ivory Coast civil war over the past 2 years. It says they include mass executions, torture, rape, and the activities of death squads. A Pakistani military court has sentenced one soldier to death and another to 10 years in prison for involvement in an attempt to assassinate President Pervez Musharraf. And the interim Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas has arrived in the West Bank town of Bethlehem for Christmas celebrations. The Israelis have eased travel restrictions for this year's celebrations. BBC News.
Now here's Alex Ritson with a special edition of World Business Report recorded on the coast of the Caspian Sea in Kazakhstan.
This boat is about as far from the modern world as it's possible to get these days. Despite an icy wind, the sun is shining brightly, the air is crisp, and I'm chugging out westwards along the Ural River into the Caspian Sea, which stretches out as an undulating green emptiness, with the exception of just one oil tanker on the very far horizon. The nearest town, in fact the only town for about 400 miles, is Atyrau. I can just see the outskirts from here over the stern of the boat. That's the odd tin roof, concrete office block. Not really remarkable in any way. In fact, nothing at all which would tell you this is one of the most important places in the world for the caviar industry. But something's gone badly wrong. A quarter of a century ago, Kazakhstan harvested around 1,100 tons of caviar each year. Last year, the caviar haul was just 8 tons, not even 1% of the previous total. The captain of this boat is Igor Tokayev.
I've been fishing here since 1974. Before that, my father and my grandfather fished here, so I know about the changes that have taken place. For me, one of the biggest changes recently has been the fall in the number of fish that we catch, especially sturgeon. That's what we get beluga caviar from. We can make a living from the Caspian at the moment, but if the numbers keep falling, then who knows? I really hope we can continue to fish around here so that my children, who are fishermen too, can have a happy working life out on the boat like I've enjoyed.
If you believe the myths, the local fisherfolk of around 300 years ago used to rip the slimy egg sacs from sturgeon and feed them to their pigs. By the 18th century, Russian aristocrats had developed a taste for the stuff and insisted on carting live sturgeon with them when they travelled, which could be sliced open whenever fresh caviar was required. Then, in the days of the Soviet Union, the fishermen of Atyrau were obliged to hand their catch over to a government-sanctioned cartel. But whoever was in charge, the fishermen have made a good living, even though their caviar has generated even bigger profits elsewhere. Igor's mother, Irena, is 82 years old.
The best period for fishermen in this area were those years when my children were growing up. Of course, back then there were lots of sturgeon being caught out in the sea, and we led a good life. But the fishermen only sold the sturgeon to the factories. That was our income. The factories were responsible for extracting the caviar, so we didn't see that much money. The best year around here was 1967. I remember it fondly, because the village was known as Millionaire Village. Can you believe it? The local government were well off, and lots of money was spent on building schools and kindergartens. It was a golden era, socially. We all felt wealthy, and it was something we used to like talking about. But slowly, the number of sturgeon started to decrease, and life became harder. By the 1990s, the fish had decreased dramatically, and as far as I know, there is almost no fish now.
The place where that contrast with the good old days is more apparent than anywhere is here, at the huge Atyrau-Balik caviar processing plant. The buildings are early Soviet, almost Art Deco style, and on the way up to the main office building, I walked past long whitewashed concrete walls, which had been painted, I would guess, in the 1930s, with paintings of brave fishermen and industrious-looking fish factory workers. Even the sturgeon look happy in the pictures, seemingly unaware that they're about to be sliced open for their valuable contents. But any sense of faded glory is completely overwhelmed by the stink, the stench of rotting fish. It's everywhere here. It gets in your hair, your clothes. You simply can't get away from it. And any sense of meaningful industry is also rather spoiled by the fact that there appears to be almost no one working here. The chief executive of Atyrau-Balik is Talgat Akhanov. He didn't seem to be too sure what had caused the plunge in the sturgeon population.
We've been considering this problem, and even scientists from Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan and Russia aren't really sure what's going on. They seem to think it's all down to how much fish are in this part of the Caspian Sea, and whether or not they choose to swim into the Ural River to reproduce. Perhaps the fish are going somewhere else to breed and lay their eggs now.
So, that's one possible explanation. Shannon Crownover works in Kazakhstan for the environmental group Caviar Emptor. She told me Kazakhstan's declaration of independence from the Soviet Union in 1991 removed a crucial degree of protection for the sturgeon.
The Caspian sturgeon is an ancient species that's been almost wiped off the face of the planet just within the past two decades. And that's because of an overwhelming global demand for its caviar, which are the eggs of the Caspian sturgeon. The sturgeon has to be killed in order for the caviar to be removed. Fishing is the main problem because when the Soviet Union broke apart, so did the regulations that monitored the species. And so overfishing is a major problem. Illegal fishing is rampant.
30 years ago, a plunge of at least 90% in fish stocks would have been a catastrophe for the entire region. But as the caviar industry has declined, a new source of jobs and wealth has arrived that should more than take its place. Beneath the Caspian seabed are two enormous oil fields which are predicted to catapult Kazakhstan above several members of the OPEC cartel in terms of oil production. Despite the traditional hostility between environmental groups and energy companies, Shannon Crownover says their arrival isn't necessarily bad news.
I believe that the oil companies that are here want to do a good job. I would hope that the oil companies would want to be involved in helping the fish recover. They do pay an environmental tax to the government, and so there is a lot more money that the government should be spending on helping save the sturgeon as well as the caviar industry, which to date has really not sent a lot of money back to the region to help this fish.
Under a United Nations-backed plan, the five nations which border the Caspian have agreed to take a total of only 4.5 tons of caviar from the sea in 2005. With the caviar market at an all-time high, that's worth a lot of money, around $3 million a ton by the time it reaches the exclusive food stores of Europe and the United States. But it's not even a fraction of 1% of the income that Kazakhstan is already enjoying from oil. No one knows exactly how much crude is waiting to be pumped out, but Talgat Imangaliev from Tengiz Chevrol, which has been operating for more than 10 years, says the wealth generated by energy companies is already transforming the lives of people across Kazakhstan.
Economic-wise, it's one-third of the country's revenue. That's how much petroleum industry brings this country. There are other effects that petroleum industry has on this country. Think of people. We, as a single company, employ thousands of people. We have numerous contractors that work for us that they're in own turn employ even more people. Think of the infrastructure development. Think of those social programs that we have to help the region that we're in.
Before I left his gleaming office, Talgat Imangaliev from Tengiz Chevrol gave me directions for a 10-minute drive across town to a completely new school. It's just one example of how money from Kazakhstan's oil bonanza is benefiting the local population. Well, after a couple of wrong turns on the way, I found it and I'm standing outside it now. It is big, it is modern looking, the windows are large and the playground is well maintained. Quite a contrast, actually, with the rest of the town, which appears to be mainly composed of miles and miles of communist-era concrete apartment blocks. But this is just one school, and while it's good news for the 300 or so kids that come here, Kazakhstan is a country of 15 million people. Around half of them are in Kazakhstan's two cities, but the rest are scattered over a territory roughly the same size as Western Europe. When I met local journalist Artur Shaznarayan, he told me that while the oil industry brings benefits, in the main, they're spread pretty thinly.
Things have changed a lot in Ati Rao over the last 5 years. A lot of money has come in because of the oil industry, but that doesn't mean that life has become better for everyone. In fact, it's probably the reverse. There is a bigger disparity between the rich and poor, something that I could never have imagined in the days of communism. The wealthy, foreigners or those locals lucky enough to work for the oil companies enjoy a good life. They live in segregated, gated housing complexes with their own schools and sporting complexes. We call it the American village, but life is hard for everyone else. The oil money has driven prices higher for food and rent. Actually, eating in a restaurant has become so expensive, it's beyond the reach of many of us.
Despite that apparent influx of foreigners, companies have to do a great deal of paperwork for every non-Kazakh citizen they wish to hire. But the Kazakh government hopes the biggest wealth creation effect will come from its national fund. It's modelled on a scheme from Norway, which was aimed at preventing the Scandinavian country from suffering the so-called oil curse, where a country's oil riches are shared out among a select few, with the wider population complaining they've not seen the benefits. Since the Kazakh funds launched 3 years ago, more than $2 billion has been saved away. Oil trader Yosef Todorovsky says that will be invested to build other industries, industries that otherwise would not exist.
They will concentrate on the new technologies, new industries, and oil business in the main thing. It's very easy money. The treasure is in the ground, so you just need to take it out and to sell it. This is product which is very much required all over the world, and the price probably will go up. So they would like to use this advantage which they have as a country, and they will be focused there, not on the caviar. Caviar, I think, it will play just a third, fourth role in the country, not the second even. The industry of caviar will die definitely. Nobody care about that. Only small companies are doing business, running business. Everything is focused on oil industry.
My visit to Ati Rao is at an end. I'm in the taxi on the way to the airport, and just as a postscript to all this, a few moments ago I stopped off at what I was led to believe was the only shop in town where caviar was likely to be on sale. It was slightly surreal in that the shop also sold plumbing equipment. Anyway, it didn't have any caviar, and the lady behind the counter didn't know when she'd be getting any fresh supplies. I hope I'll get the chance to return here in a couple of years' time, and if I do, I'll go back to that shop. It'll be interesting to see what its main line of business is then.
That was Alex Ritson reporting from Kazakhstan. I'm Jo Fidgen, and you're listening to the BBC. It's 18:45 GMT. The latest headlines: campaigning is ending in Ukraine's long and bitterly fought presidential election, with the two candidates making their final appeals to voters ahead of the election rerun on Sunday. The opposition candidate, Viktor Yushchenko, told reporters in the capital, Kiev, that healing social divisions would be his top priority. His opponent, the Prime Minister, Viktor Yanukovych, said that voting for him would ensure Ukraine's destiny remained in the hands of its people. The US Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld has been making a pre-Christmas visit to boost morale at American bases in Iraq. Mr. Rumsfeld told a group of soldiers that although the situation looked bleak, he remained confident of defeating the insurgency and stabilizing Iraq. And an unpublished United Nations report obtained by the French newspaper Libération says both sides in the Ivory Coast conflict have committed a series of atrocities. We'll have more news in 15 minutes. This is the BBC. At this time of year, many people in Western countries spend endless hours wandering through the shops in search of Christmas presents. It can be a very stressful business. Millions of dollars are invested in persuading people to make the right choice, to buy the right product. The whole idea of choice has become a buzzword, not just in shopping, but also in UK politics. The main political parties here are promising voters they'll be able to choose between a variety of hospitals and schools. But how to make up your mind? And does having better choices mean having more options? Belinda Rhodes has been investigating, starting in a busy London supermarket.